yourself a song to sing, and sing it till you're done. Yeah, sing it hard and sing it well. Send the robber barons straight to hell. The greedy thieves who came around and ate the flesh of everything they found, whose crimes have gone unpunished now, walk the streets a-screaming now. Greetings, all you 99 percenters. This is your host, Dr. Jack Rasmus. This is Alternative Visions. Okay, today we got a special show with a special guest here. We're going to talk about politics and democracy. It's kind of appropriate, I would say. We got impeachment proceedings going on in Congress, and we have the whole Trump phenomenon here over the last several years, and during which clearly Democratic institutions, norms, and practices are in decline. But as I've been saying in previous weeks here, you know, Trump is just the continuation of neoliberal policies, albeit a neoliberalism on steroids, you might say, 2.0, a more virulent, aggressive form of neoliberal policies. As it's pretty clear, the U.S. and global economy has not fully recovered from the 2008-09 crash, including in the U.S., notwithstanding all the nonsense and misrepresentations and lies you get in the media about, oh, we're fully recovered. No, quite the contrary. Tens of millions of people in this country have not recovered, and that's part of the crisis that we've got here. The point I've always made about neoliberalism, and this is the theme of today, you might say, is that neoliberal policies, now Trump trying to resurrect them in a more aggressive form following the crisis of 2008-09 and the failure of Obama to do so, neoliberalism is incompatible with democracy. And very clearly, as I pointed out in my just-released book, The Scourge of Neoliberalism, U.S. Policy from Reagan to Trump, progressively along the way in the last several decades of neoliberal expansion, we see the restriction and the decline of even the limited form of democracy that we have in this country. It is being chipped away and it is disappearing. On a number of fronts, and what's going on in Congress now with the impeachment is only the last vestige, most recent vestige and indication of this decline of democracy. Okay, so let me just recap very briefly, as I can, here the last several shows in which I've been talking about what is this thing neoliberalism. And then I want to talk about specifically neoliberalism versus democracy. And then in the second half of this show, we have a special guest coming on, Alan Benjamin, and a special conference coming up in Cleveland about creating a third party here, alternative, because the both wings of the corporate party of America, as I call it, we don't have a two-party system. We have a single-party system with two wings and two groups of elites running both wings. And, of course, they are engaged in a food fight, political food fight right now, and they have been for a couple years here. I'm talking about the Democrats and the Republicans, two wings of the corporate party of America. So we only have a single party, and in the second half of the show, we're going to talk about it, what it takes to create a true second party in U.S. political spectrum here. Okay, so back to the brief recap, neoliberalism. You know, academics and intellectuals like to talk about ideas, and they claim that neoliberalism actually originated in the 1970s with a new set of ideas about efficient markets and free markets and get the government out and balance the budget and so forth. And these intellectuals argue that, oh, that gave rise to Reaganomics, which is the U.S. version of early neoliberalism. Okay, so ideas created neoliberalism. You know, intellectuals can be very arrogant to think that their ideas is what drives political reality. But as I argued in the book, look, you know, it's the political reality comes first, and that neoliberalism is the creation of capitalism in the 1970s, big business, big corporations, as a way of confronting the crisis that it faced in the 1970s. And that crisis was composed of challenges domestically and challenges from other capitalists abroad. So neoliberalism is really a response to the crisis and an attempt to contain and roll back domestic challenges. I'm talking about unions and social movements and so forth and democratic movements in the 1970s. And it's also about rolling back challenges from abroad, maintaining U.S. global capitalist hegemony. Of course, the challengers from abroad were Europe and Japan at that time. So neoliberalism is really about a set of policies about reasserting U.S. capitalist class dominance. It's really about class and class conflict. And to use the term neoliberal is kind of an obfuscation because there's nothing liberal about neoliberalism. As I point out in the first chapter of my book, comparing classical liberalism to neoliberalism, they're really quite different. But neoliberalism calls upon these ideas of classic liberalism to justify neoliberalism in practice, which is really about a set of four areas of policies designed to roll back challengers and to ensure U.S. capital's global hegemony for decades to come. This occurred in the late 1970s. It began neoliberalism in practice, and that's what I'm going to talk about from now on, is really composed of four policy areas. One is fiscal policy, i.e. spending, social spending, war spending, and taxation, whether it's for corporations and investors or for consumers and households, and deficit and debt management. That's fiscal policy. The second area is monetary policy. Neoliberalism attempts to maintain very low interest rates, because if it maintains very, very low interest rates, gets the Federal Reserve and monetary policy to ensure low interest rates, that means that the dollar stays low, another element of neoliberalism. Why does it like the dollar, a low dollar valuation? Because that means U.S. multinational corporations that have penetrated the global economy can then convert their profits in the local currency into more dollars when they ship those, repatriate those dollars back to the U.S. headquarters. So low dollar is very important for neoliberalism, as well as low interest rates are important. On the fiscal side, it's increased defense spending, war spending, compress social spending on social programs. Neoliberalism also doesn't care about creating deficits, whether they're trade deficits or budget deficits and the debt. In that sense, it's very much unlike classical liberalism, for example. Okay, so that's monetary policy. Neoliberalism is also about industrial policy. What is that? Well, you know, critics of neoliberalism say, well, privatization and deregulation. Well, yes, that's part of it. But there's more to it than just that. On industrial policy, it's about destroying unions, undermining unions to keep wages low, and converting good-paying manufacturing jobs, sending them offshore and abroad, and converting people to low-paid service jobs, and usually contingent or precarious low-paid service jobs increasingly. And that keeps the wages low and keeps the working class fragmented. And at the same time, you destroy unions. At the same time, precarious jobs means business doesn't pay benefits at all. And it also means bringing skilled foreign labor onshore, particularly in the tech industry, which accounts for preventing U.S. citizens from getting good jobs in software engineering and so forth. That kind of reached the peak under Bill Clinton. 500,000 people coming in as engineers and so forth, being brought in by tech companies a year, 500,000 a year, being brought in on H-1B and L-1 and 2 visas. And the whole purpose here is wage compression. Keep wages down. Eliminate benefits, privatize benefits. And a number of other areas, too, like privatizing pensions and the whole privatization of health care benefits. All of these are part of industrial policy. And then finally, trade policy, or what I call external policy. Here the hallmark is free trade, right? Free trade. And free trade, as we'll see, means a conscription of democratic rights. Well, I'll explain what that means. But it's not just free trade, a flow of goods back and forth across borders as the U.S. penetrates foreign markets, U.S. multinational corporations and banks more and more. It's about bringing back goods made by U.S. companies abroad without having to pay tariffs. For example, in China, 49% of the goods imported to the U.S. are made in whole or part by U.S. corporations in China. Of course, you won't hear anything about doing something about the tariffs on U.S. corporations, but the flow back in goods is really U.S. corporations. But free trade is not just about goods flows. It's about money capital flows. Read the NAFTA agreement. It's mostly about conditions in which bankers and U.S. corporations can bring money into these other countries to set up their production of goods that they would then ship back to the U.S. But the final area here of importance is currency exchange rate policy. That's part of external policy of neoliberalism, keeping the dollar low, for example. Another element is what I call the twin deficits solution to the trade deficit and budget deficit. It's a policy of neoliberalism since Reagan to create a trade deficit, a massive trade deficit, which means more dollars flow offshore from the U.S. into emerging market economies. But then the agreement is made with indigenous capitalists in these countries to recycle this money back to the U.S. by buying treasury bonds and other goods, securities, with which the U.S. Uses to fill the gap in the deficit, you see. The trade deficit and the recycling of dollars provides the opportunity to create a budget deficit. And, of course, that budget deficit is created largely by massive tax cuts for investors and corporations on the one hand and escalating war spending. Since 2001, the U.S. has implemented $15 trillion in tax cuts, 80% of which at least has gone to corporations, businesses, and investors. And, of course, it's increased defense spending, war spending, by $7 trillion. Well, there's your $22 trillion deficit in debt in the U.S., but that is enabled by the twin deficit and the recycling of dollars back to the U.S. Okay, those are the four areas of neoliberal policy, neoliberalism in practice. It has evolved, neoliberalism has evolved since Reagan, expanding and deepening. Reagan did not have a true external policy here. It was fiscal and it was monetary and industrial, but he lacked the trade policy. That was implemented, of course, under our friend here, Bill Clinton, right? It would have been impossible to establish NAFTA, for example, and multilateral free trade agreements without the Democratic Party blocking with the Republicans to do so. So the trade policy was an additional and deepening of fiscal and monetary policies, neoliberal policies, occurred under Clinton, as I point out in that chapter of my book. And then we have neoliberalism on steroids here with George W. Bush, where all these four areas are firing on all four cylinders, you might say. Then we have the crisis of 2008 and 9, and that's when neoliberalism hit the wall. In other words, these four areas of policy reached a hiatus. They didn't continue deepening, and some of them didn't continue at all. The crisis of 2008 means a crisis of neoliberal policy. And ever since 2000, in fact, we've seen the growing contradictions on a number of fronts between these four policies. Neoliberalism is a certain policy mix of these four particular areas, and it represents a restructuring, as I said, of global capitalism to face the challenge of the 1970s. Well, it is breaking down. The contradictions are intensifying in neoliberal policy, and it is now breaking down. As I also point out in a chapter in the book, this is just the third restructuring, capitalist restructuring. Neoliberalism is the third restructuring. U.S. capital has done this before, right before World War I, when the outcome was U.S. capitalists became co-equals globally with the British and European capital. And it did it after World War II, when the U.S. Capital became hegemonic, in other words, dominant in the world. That dominance was challenged in the 1970s, and of course, neoliberalism, the third restructuring, was all about reinstituting U.S. Capital dominance at home and abroad. Okay, in addition to the theme that it began to break down after 2008, is the theme that along the way, neoliberalism expansion required the restriction, conscription, and restriction of democracy. In other words, neoliberalism is incompatible with democracy. And as it reached a crisis in 2008 under Obama, which is neoliberalism on opioids, the attack on democracy intensified. And now under Trump, as he's trying to restore neoliberalism, and he's only done so partially, he's failed in trade policy, he's sort of failed in monetary policy, he can't get the Fed to lower rates in the dollar as much as he wants, he succeeded in war spending policy, he succeeded in massive tax cutting, he hasn't succeeded yet in social spending cuts. Trump and the Democrats have a devil's agreement that the Democrats allow defense and war spending to increase if Trump does not reduce social spending. So he's failed there, and he's failed on external policy. He succeeded on fiscal policy and deregulation and so forth. So it's a mixed picture for Trump. But I argue that there are developments at the core of U.S. capitalism, natural capitalist developments, that will mean that he cannot restore it. I don't believe he cannot restore it, and the question is, what comes after that? Well, what comes after that is an even more aggressive proto-fascist kind of policy mix in the 2020s, or a new progressive policy mix in the 2020s. That's to be determined. Let's talk very briefly here in the next 10 minutes on how neoliberalism is incompatible with democracy. Well, if you look back in the origins of neoliberalism, capitalists intensified their control of the two political parties in the 1980s. The Republican Party right away, we have the formation of the Business Council and the Business Roundtable. CEOs began engaging in politics and lobbying like never before. The religious right was brought into the strategy. In other words, the capitalists took over more direct control of the Republican Party. And the Democratic Party, the same thing happened in the late 1980s. And what happened was a faction called the Democratic Leadership Conference, which were the money bags of the Democratic Party, reasserted himself in the Democratic Party and really took over the direction of that party after 1988. Their boy, of course, was Bill Clinton, and they've been in control ever since. And their subsequent boys were, Al Gore and Barack Obama. And, of course, Joe Biden is part of that, part of the DLC faction that really is the Democratic Party today. So we have this transformation of the political parties that occur under neoliberalism. They become more pro-business, pro-corporate. Then we have the attempt to penetrate Congress even more deeply, and that occurs in 1994 with Newt Gingrich and the radical right taking over the House of Representatives and publicly declaring their whole purpose was to create dysfunctional government. We have a coalition formed between the Democrats and the Republicans parties in the 1990s that enables NAFTA and welfare reform, privatization of health care and pensions, corporate-favored tax reform, contingent precarious labor, offshoring, H-1B, all these things began intensifying under the deepening of neoliberalism under Bill Clinton. But it's the party transformation behind it that enables all of this. And, of course, we have the creation of NAFTA, and NAFTA means you're creating business-controlled legislative bodies and courts that really take out from the U.S. Constitution certain authority that should be relegated to elected representatives. In other words, these treaty courts under NAFTA and free trade and business people negotiating these things, they become their representatives, they become the judges on the court, represents a decline in sovereignty, popular sovereignty. We also see a clear electoral decline going on under neoliberalism from the very beginning until the early 2000s when electoral campaign reform, campaign finance reform, pretty much becomes a dead letter here. Ever since the late 1970s, campaign finance reform, in other words, electoral reform of democracy, is part of the front of neoliberalism attempting to open up the political system so it could push through these very onerous policies, economic policies, that benefit capital at the expense of workers and others. So campaign finance reform is part of the electoral decline of neoliberalism during its reign here since the 1980s. Then we have a further transformation of the Supreme Court. Yeah, of course, the Supreme Court selects the president in 2000, Gore versus Bush, gives Bush, by stopping the count, the vote count in Florida, gives Bush one electoral vote more than necessary to become the president. So he was not elected. He was selected by the Supreme Court. And then, of course, when neoliberalism hits a crisis in 2008, we have the Supreme Court passing Citizens United that opens up the political system even more to moneyed interests. Now, it's important to understand that the Supreme Court has no authority under the U.S. Constitution to declare laws unconstitutional or to select presidents, right? Under the Constitution, it should have gone to the House of Representatives if there was a dispute in 2000. But the Supreme Court stepped in and assumed that authority, as it has for a long time, assumed the authority to declare laws constitutional. Read the U.S. Constitution. There is nothing in it that gives the Supreme Court that authority. The Supreme Court usurped that authority back in the early 1800s. When we had a democratic revolution under Jefferson, and the Supreme Court chair or head there, and his name was Marshall, was a buddy of John Adams, and that was the merchant interest that preceded the Jeffersonian Revolution. He was a buddy, and Adams stuck him in there to put him the head of the Supreme Court. There was no head at that time, and the Supreme Court is really a creation of Congress. Therefore, Congress has authority over the Supreme Court. But the Supreme Court has usurped the right to declare the sovereign elected representatives' decisions unconstitutional. It has no right. And we're seeing now in the neoliberalism a new assertive, aggressive Supreme Court coming out on behalf of corporate and business interests. The Electoral College, of course, is another area of drift towards undemocratic practices, of course. And we see this now with 32 states have a larger share of electors per their population than they should have. But there's no adjustment of that. Trump could win the next election. He doesn't need the popular vote because the Electoral College. Very clearly, he could, and because he's controlling the red states. You see, the Republicans and the radical right have this red state strategy, which enables them to dominate the Senate and dominate through the Electoral College the presidency and presidential elections. Okay, so this drift towards the Electoral College playing a bigger role is another example of a decline of democracy, because democracy should be one person, one vote, but that's not the case. You vote for electors, and different states determine their electors in different ways. And in fact, the electors can vote any way they want. They don't have to vote for the popular vote for one candidate or another. It's very undemocratic. But now this form, archaic form called Electoral College, is playing more and more of a role to prevent democracy deepening, along with campaign finance reform, along with the shift to the right in the Supreme Court. But even more so than this, we see the return of voter suppression, a kind of Jim Crow light occurring, particularly in the red states, which, of course, are controlled by the Republican right, and the red states, in turn, allows them to retain control of the electoral colleges. If you look at voter suppression, it's occurring mostly in the red states: Florida, Ohio, North Carolina, North Dakota, Texas, Kentucky. This is where Georgia, in particular, right? This is where the red states are eliminating, preventing people from voting, engaging in fraud, like in North Carolina, from voting, closing voting places, purging rolls, stopping of new voter registration, requiring voter IDs, right, software machines. And the Supreme Court has supported this year. They can purge voting polls, for example. So you see how the different institutions are working together to limit democracy. Another interesting thing about a democratic system is that under the Constitution, it's required to add representatives to the House of Representatives as the population not only shifts but grows. We haven't added to the House of Representatives any new representatives, despite the huge population growth since 1913. There should be many more people in the House of Representatives, which means that they would be from states like California and so forth, not from the red states or from the South. But that's not been even raised by either party, either wing of the corporate party of America, but it should. Gerrymandering, another big problem in recent years, particularly since 2000, again, mostly in the red states: Georgia, North Carolina, Florida, Texas, Arkansas, Louisiana, Kentucky, Tennessee, South Carolina, West Virginia, Arizona, right? I presume everyone knows what gerrymandering is, but along with voter suppression are two indications of further decline in democracy in this country. Money in politics, well, Citizens United and all the decisions related to it, in elections, you know, it costs like $20 million to run for senator in a major state. Well, how many people can do that? Only corporations and wealthy investors can finance that. And then we have the lobbyist state. We have 35,000 registered lobbyists in Washington, D.C. alone. And these are corporate. These are wealthy groups, trade groups, and so forth. So money is corrupting not only in elections, but in after elections through this lobbying state and revolving doors between businesses and government, state-level privatization groups like the ALEC, American Legislative Exchange Council, which creates legislation, private, you know, funded by the Koch brothers, creates private legislation templates and gives it to state legislatures to pass. And there was a privatization of democracy at the state level going on. Free trade. I talked already about capitalist legislatures and capitalist courts that really determine the outcome of free trade. Finally, we see the attack on civil liberties and democratic rights that have intensified since 9/11 and the Patriot Act and the National Defense Authorization Act ever since. Again, we got these courts. You know, who selects these people to FISA courts? Citizens are considered enemy combatants under the Patriot Act and NDAA, which means that they can take away all your citizens' rights. Search and seizure in violation of the U.S. Article 4 of the U.S. Constitution. They can go after you without warrants, and even if they have to get warrants, you know, the FISA courts have, I think, only refused the FBI and the CIA and others 12 warrants out of all the warrants. 500 million telephone records are gathered simply by, you know, the FBI and others issuing what's called national security letters. Definition of a terrorist: if you unknowingly contribute money to an front organization that they determine is a terrorist, you are a terrorist by their definition. And the NDAA provides for military detention if necessary. So we have this apparatus that is sort of infringing on our civil liberties, but in a crisis will come down hard on everybody. The structure is there to prevent us from exercising our civil liberties. Now, Trump represents an intensification of all this. We have now a constitutional crisis in the U.S. government itself, in the institutions itself. The two wings of the corporate party of America are engaging in an intense pissing match. And that's how you should see all this stuff going on in Congress and the impeachment and so forth. It's two wings of the elite fighting it out. And about the constitutional government itself. We've got Trump on the one hand usurping congressional authority, using national security declarations, legislation by executive orders, diverting congressional funding to pay for his wall and other projects. That's a usurpation of Congress. We have Trump, who has declared he is above the law and he can pardon himself if he wants. Well, that's tyranny, right? Pure and simple. And of course, the maneuvering around the farce called the Mueller investigation, the War Powers Act expansion going on, refusing to allow administrative officials to testify during the Mueller investigation, and of course now during the impeachment process, obstruction of justice or obstruction is rampant in this administration, and attacks on the press. Fake news, right? We all know, we've all heard what that is, freezing out critical sources that are critical of Trump from press conferences, vilification of journalists and so forth. So what we got as neoliberalism is fading in its effect to deliver for capitalism. In other words, it hit the crisis in 2008, and we have this attempt by Trump to restructure and resurrect it in a more virulent, aggressive form. We have an intensifying attack on democracy itself, which has been going on from the very beginning, because democracy is an obstacle to neoliberalism and capitalists maintaining their domestic and global hegemony in this country. And they are chipping away at it. And they are eliminating elements of democratic rights, voter repression, gerrymandering, so forth, lobbying, revolving doors, etc., step by step. Now, you know, you're not going to get a fundamental change from either wing of the corporate party of America. That's pretty clear. They're only engaging in protecting their own mutual interest. And, of course, they have different interpretation of what strategy should be followed here in the 21st century, and that's what their fight is all about. Nothing's going to change until there is a true second party. And now I want to introduce my guest as a result, because there are efforts underway to establish a true independent second party in this country. You know, the number one question, as I've said, is the organizational question. I think that the vast majority of people in the United States want a fundamental change, but there's no organization structure for them to turn to. You know, there's just these two wings of the corporate party of America. If there were a true third party, you would see, a tremendous shift towards support for such a true second party in this country. How you break through is another question, creating such a party, because, just demonstrating in the streets, you know, whether it's like Occupy or Yellow Vest or something, or even in Hong Kong, the capitalists just wait you out, right? You have to contend for the institutions of power within a country if you want to have real change. That means you must contend on electoral basis as well as other ways, non-electorally, but you need a political party to do that. Well, my guest here, Alan Benjamin, is part of an initiative that's going on right now at a conference coming up in Cleveland, I think, in a week or so, about efforts of a union and other working people to form such a second party. And I'd like to introduce him now and have him tell us something about what's going on with this conference and his view about the crisis, the Democratic crisis, and why a second party is necessary. Alan, are you there?
Yes, I am. Thank you.
Alan, tell us what's going on in Cleveland here on December 7th with this conference, and ad lib on whatever you think why a second party is really necessary.
Yeah, thanks, Jack. First, I want to just say I totally agree with your assessment of the dangers that threaten the democracy that we've been able to win and wrest through struggle. Democratic rights and gains have always been the product of class struggle and of fight to expand the rights that working people have the right to, that they are entitled to. And, of course, that's a long history in this country. As we know, from the earliest days, the majority of the population was denied those rights, and we've had to win them. So the issue of a second party, I think you're correct to formulate it as a second party and not a third party, because you have one of the bosses, Tony Mazzocchi, who at one time was the founder of the Labor Party movement in the 1990s and Secretary Treasurer of the Oil, Chemical, and Atomic Workers Union, would say the bosses have two parties. We need one of our own. And that still holds true today. Cleveland, Ohio, has been central to the historic struggle for a new party. The founding convention of the Labor Party in the mid-1990s was in Cleveland, 1,400 delegates representing more than 2 million workers. And that was put on hold when the pressures of lesser evilism reemerged on the labor movement, and you had to toe the line, go support the Democrats, lest you be accused of being a spoiler, and the whole... You mentioned the Nader Well, you mentioned the selection of George W. Bush, which was actually true. But of course, in the labor movement, that narrative, the truth of what happened, the failure to really pinpoint the origins of the selection, led to a counteroffensive, which was presented as follows. 5% that went towards the Green candidacy of Ralph Nader was responsible for giving us George Bush. Never play around with the third party or second party, because all it's going to do is give us Republicans. And that pressure of lesser evilism has always weighed down heavily on the unions. I've said, and folks I work with in the labor community for an independent party, LSIP, and with the Clean Break wing of the labor movement, we've always said that the major obstacle toward building an independent working class party, a second party, a majority party, because we are the majority in this country, is the labor officialdom and the labor movement's reliance on the Democratic Party. And that we have to break through that reliance and build structures within the labor movement, like they've been doing in terms of, there's got to be a break with the two parties and not accept the blackmail of this. And so we really have a dangerous situation. Right now, what we're doing with the labor community for an independent party is building a wing within the labor movement to break through with that reliance on the Democratic Party that says we've got to start running our own candidates locally. Why locally? Because we know that we have to build up towards a situation where we can actually less realism. So we have to start on community coalitions that begin to forge this new party from the bottom up, from the grassroots, within the unions, the teachers who have been on this revolt for over a year, with the reform movements in the unions. And the main problem we face right now is the Bernie candidacy. Bernie has given voice and expressed to huge, very important issues, single payer, Medicare for all, free public education, tax the rich, rebuild our infrastructure. He's even mentioned the need to nationalize, I don't know if he hasn't followed up on it, but the fossil fuel industry. All of these are very important, but he brings people back into the Democratic Party rather than say, the only way we're going to win these rights is by building our own political voice, our own political instrument. Rather than saying that, he's saying, let's do it within the Democratic Party. And in 2016, the election was rigged, we know. The primary was rigged. Today, they're going after Bernie Sanders again. The DNC, as you pointed out, the leadership, the Democratic Leadership Council, is pulling out all stops. It's summoning Obama to go on the campaign trail, not to combat Trump and the Republicans, but to go after his primary target is to go after Bernie Sanders. That's been said. This has been written. It's been written about. And Obama has not hidden the fact that if Bernie Sanders continues to lead or be a major contender, they're going to pull out all stops to stop him, including rigging the election again, which is what they can do because they're a private entity and they can do whatever they want. And so the issue that we face is how do we help give a direction to the millions who will vote for Sanders to say, you're going to get stolen, your hopes are going to get shattered once again. What can we do now to start building from the bottom a political voice of our own, laying the foundations for a new second majority working class, class-based working class party, because the unions, we have to fight for the unions to break with the Democrats and to be part of the solution, not part of the problem. And it's going to be a big fight within the unions. And we're going to meet in Cleveland this weekend to map out that strategy. Where can we begin running local candidates as part of this effort for a labor community party, labor and community? Because one of the problems with the Labor Party is that it kept the Black and Latino and other women's rights, LGBTQ activists out of the picture. This was strictly union, and it was not seen as a majority working class party. And the second problem with the Labor Party is it was a contradiction in terms. You can't have a Labor Party that doesn't contest for power against the Democrats, and they refuse to run candidates. And so the beginning salvo running candidates presenting an alternative point of view, an alternative platform, addressing that organizational question that you mentioned, Jack, that is the central question. And we're going to have to begin small. We're going to have to begin modestly. But we can create a national committee that can coordinate these efforts. And it'll involve Greens, and it'll involve people from a lot of the minority parties. But we can't structure a new working class party based on what exists today. The Green Party and others have to be part of an umbrella, a coalition party of working people and all the oppressed, and they have their role. The socialist different tendencies have to be part of this effort as well. But a labor party, labor community party, has to be much more, has to be structured on the organizations that the class has created, the working class that the Black organizations have created, by breaking with the Democrats. So it's not an easy effort. We're constantly, just this morning, I got a note from a supporter, a unionist. I was part of the Labor Party. I think that we need a third party more than ever, but begin even thinking about laying the foundations or even going honestly as you're proposing to build the third party right now is dumb. I couldn't think of anything dumber. What we need right now is to just unite to dump Trump, and we'll worry about the rest later. And, of course, that has been the logic over so many decades. We have to get rid of the Republicans. That's enabled the whole political spectrum to move to the right, to embrace neoliberalism. Today, Jack, you have a situation where the Democrats are going to be, within the next days, I believe, supporting and calling to support the new U.S.-Mexico-Canada agreement, the new free trade agreement. They're going to claim that there's been a lot of labor rights, that there's finally, with Mexico, there's an agreement to ensure the protection of labor and environmental rights, which is all a bunch of bunk, because the whole premise of these free trade agreements is to break barriers of trade, labor rights, state enterprises. And it's going to be one more case of collaboration at the summit between the two parties against working people. And unfortunately, it appears that Trumpka of the AFL-CIO is going to buy into it, say, we did the best we could, and Trump is going to claim victory, and Pelosi is going to say, we did the best we could, we've got to go with this free trade agreement because it's good for big business. And
well, you know, Alan, I agree with you that the time is ripe here. The way I see the political system over the next year is the Democrat, the DLC, moneybag wing, will under no condition allow Sanders to be their candidate. They are prepared to, and you can see them maneuvering as Joe Biden fades, bringing in new possible moneybag candidates like Bloomberg and so forth on their behalf. They're going to do everything to stop, above board and below board to stop Sanders. And if Sanders wins primaries, they will still find a way to prevent him from being a candidate at the Democratic convention when it occurs. And I think that will completely debunk the illusion that you can have progressive policies that benefit working people, and a progressive candidate championed those policies within the structure of the Democratic Party, because the DLC moneybag faction runs that party right now. And if they should do that, which I think they will, if they should do that, they, the Democrat leadership, and lose the election in November, which is, I believe, it's a 50-50 toss-up at best because of the way the Republicans and the corporate forces have engineered this red state strategy and the Electoral College, you know, in its pocket. I think, you know, Trump could lose the popular vote by even more and still win the election. Should that happen, I think all these illusions about lesser evilism are going to collapse. So it's important that an organization structure exists before that collapse comes. I think that's the more likely scenario that we'll see over the next year.
I agree with you. It's going to be, no matter what happens, there's going to be some major cataclysmic motion. I don't think that Bernie Sanders is going to get the nomination. That's going to create a lot of chaos and crisis within the DSA and others. People are going to be looking for alternatives, and we have to have a vehicle that embraces them and the issues that they fight for and says, let's work together. Let's build a coalition party, a majority coalition party rooted in the labor movement and the communities of the oppressed. And I don't know if it's 50-50. I do know that I travel a lot around the world for doing labor organizing. And people keep saying, you know, here the United States claims to be the bulwark of democracy and imposes it at gunpoint and kills people in the name of democracy. You had a candidate who won by 3 million votes in the popular election and lost an election. So don't ever come back and tell us about democracy and democratic rights. You can't even implement those in your own country. I couldn't agree with you more that the undemocratic structures are such that it's just rigged to begin with. That electoral college must go, and among so many other of the vestiges of...
The electoral college, plus the control of the red states through gerrymandering and voter suppression, and all of which have intensified...
Everything that you've mentioned...
Is the key.
So it could very well be that because of that, somebody as unpopular as Trump could actually win. I don't know if it's 50-50. I think that there are fissures within the Republicans. Who knows? But what I do know is that unless we have a vehicle, and I really thank you for your support to the continued efforts to build a second party, and I'm hoping that we can work together and be on the show to let people know. The conference is in Cleveland, Saturday, December 7th. I don't know when you air this program, if that will have come and gone, but I'd be glad to give a report.
We would like to definitely have you back, give a report on that. The show, of course, this show, Alternative Vision, airs tomorrow. We're recording it right now for the audience. Tomorrow, Friday, December 6th, I think it is. Hopefully it's in time.
Let me urge your listeners to join us if you're in Northern Ohio. The event will take place at the Middleburg Heights Library at 11 a.m. That's in Middleburg, just one of the suburbs. I think it is one of the districts in Cleveland. And for more information, you can contact Don Bryant at 216-255-1576. Baldemar Velasquez, the president of the Farm Labor Organizing Committee, will be there. Margaret Flowers from Single Payer. Kevin Zeese, one of the four leading figures in the occupation to defend the Venezuelan consulate. He and three others are facing serious charges. possibly jail sentence for defending the consulate against an imminent takeover by the right-wing Venezuelans. There'll be Nnamdi Lumumba from the Ujima People's Progress Party. So a lot of the Latino, Black labor organizers will be there to try to map out a strategy for how we're going to start taking back our democracy. How are we going to start taking back our livelihood, our unions, our organizations, and reclaim them for struggle? Because one of the biggest problems we have is misleadership in the unions and misleadership at so many levels in the Black and Latino communities. And I mean that in terms of preventing discussions, preventing democratic debates, and essentially all because they're tied to a two-party system that's in crisis, but that is the source of so many of the ills that we face, as you pointed out.
Okay. Well, thank you for coming on, Alan. I appreciate it, and I hope your conference does well. And I hope that follow-up, you can have similar conferences in different parts of the country, and then maybe bring them together in a convention gathering sometime, you know, during the electoral cycle here next summer, and prepare an alternative voice for what I think is going to be a constitutional crisis of unimaginable dimensions in the next election next year, which will, I think, really shock people and open up the possibility for a real alternative here. Okay, so thanks again for coming on, and folks, if you want to attend the Northern Ohio, the Cleveland Conference, please call the person there and join them. We will continue our follow-up here with you and the results of your conference. Okay, so that concludes the show for today, and I hope, folks have a new perspective on what neoliberalism is all about and, what it's doing to democracy in this country. All right, that's it. Alternative Vision. Sid Wilson, Robert Burns.